It had been known since the early 20th century that, as a matter of chemistry, natural gas could be converted into a liquid and then, after transport, be reconverted into a gas for burning. This process might solve the problem of an ocean-facing, stranded gas holder like Cotter. Its gas could be turned into liquid, loaded into ocean-going tankers, shipped to populated markets, and then reconverted into gas for commercial use. The technology to accomplish this conversion and reconversion at a large scale was unwieldy, however. Britain and Algeria signed the first major commercial liquefied natural gas contract in 1961. A huge refrigeration plant in Algeria cooled that country's stranded gas into a liquid. Ships carried the liquid gas to Britain, and a reconversion plant turned it back into a fuel for electricity. Indonesia soon moved into the LNG industry, with energy-starved Japan as a customer. Mobil became the operating partner in Aceh. For years, the profitability of Mobil's LNG business in Aceh was an exceptional success, however. It relied effectively on Japan and South Korea, which were industrializing very rapidly but had few hydrocarbons of their own. They were willing to pay high prices for secure LNG supplies. The technology Mobil employed to fill these contracts was very costly, and it seemed that it would be some time before its methods would be economical enough to deploy worldwide. Exxon had a troubled history in the LNG business before the Mobil merger. The corporation had built, relatively early on, an LNG plant in Libya and a reconversion terminal in La Spezia, Italy. The Libyan plant proved to be bulky and trouble-prone. In the early 1970s, Exxon's Italian subsidiary became embroiled in scandal when the unit's president, Vincenzo Cazzaniga, was accused of setting up a web of hidden bank accounts to funnel almost $50 million of Exxon's revenue to Italian political parties, including a small amount to the country's Communist Party, to win tax and other favors. Exxon eventually entered into a consent decree with the Securities and Exchange Commission over the matter. The affair soured the corporation's executives on their Italian subsidiary, and their LNG investments languished. Mobil had stumbled into its gas partnership with Cotter during the 1990s, but it was scrappy and opportunistic. A substantial number of the oil industry's big success stories were the product of luck, not brains. Oil executives had flown in and out of Cotter for years, but none of them could think of how to commercialize the North Field. Royal Dutch Shell led the global LNG business by the 1990s. Mobil was a second-tier but significant player because of Aceh. Shell negotiated access to the North Field, but pulled out in a dispute over financial terms. British Petroleum and the French giant Total moved in afterward and negotiated to build an initial pair of LNG trains, the industry term used to describe the giant refrigeration complexes that converted pumped gas into liquid form for sea transport. The consortium struggled with some of the technical challenges. British Petroleum pulled out. They had it on a golden plate, but they rejected it. Abdullah bin Hamad Al Attiyah, Qatar's energy minister, remembered. The Qataris realized there was hardly anyone else in the global industry but Mobil who could do the work they wanted. They came immediately, recalled Al Attiyah. Lou Noto slipped into the Total deal, but he also won the exclusive right to build future Qatari gas trains. He structured a long-term sales contract for Qatari gas with South Korea as the customer and handed off the whole project to Lee Raymond at the time of the merger. The North Field challenge played to Exxon's strengths. Budget and performance-conscious management of gargantuan engineering projects combined with profit-maximizing financial planning. In Mobil's LNG group, Exxon also required technical expertise it otherwise lacked. After 2000, ExxonMobil committed to multi-billion-dollar investments to develop huge new LNG gas trains from the North Field as an exclusive 25% partner with Qatar Petroleum. Its engineers found that the Emirates' natural gas was of unusually malleable quality, relatively easy to liquefy, or to process to separate out other industrial products. This made it cheap to produce. The projects Raymond authorized in Qatar were designed to be profitable if the natural gas they produced sold at just $3 per 1,000 cubic feet. Within a few years, prices soared as high as $15. ExxonMobil's direct gas sales from Qatar took place under long-term contracts, so the corporation did not reap all of the benefits of this windfall on spot markets, but its gas-derived profits soared nonetheless. Also, the corporation's share of profits from auxiliary products manufactured in Qatar, referred to as gas liquids, would soon exceed $1 billion annually. Only ExxonMobil, Raymond boasted to Wall Street analysts, had figured out how to unlock the value of Qatar's bounty. Gas figured increasingly in the search by ExxonMobil to replace the oil and gas reserves it pumped and sold each year. The sheer scale of ExxonMobil's reserve replacement challenge each year, its need to find and book oil and gas in equivalent or greater amounts to that which it pumped out and sold, meant that the corporation had to find a Conoco every year, as Raymond put it. In 2001, ConocoPhillips had worldwide revenues of almost $40 billion. The scale problem was genuine, but it also sounded more and more like an excuse. Nobody had forced Exxon and Mobil to merge, and Raymond had advertised the combination as full of strategic advantage. In any event, ExxonMobil's total portfolio was shifting away from oil toward gas. In 2002, the corporation pumped slightly less oil than it did in 2001. In the first half of 2003, oil production fell slightly again. For Wall Street, ExxonMobil counted oil and gas reserves as a single number, as oil equivalent barrels. Analysts converted gas reserves to equivalent barrels of oil with formulas accounting for energy content and price. Yet the truth was that gas was less profitable than oil, equivalent barrel by equivalent barrel. Oil prices averaged about 30% more than natural gas on an energy equivalent basis after 1995, and the United States Energy Information Agency projected that this gap would widen into the future. Gas production could be more costly. Customer markets were less flexible, less interconnected. Yet because of resource nationalism and the depletion of accessible supplies in the United States, oil was harder and harder for ExxonMobil to own. The slow migration of ExxonMobil's reserves from oil to gas did not show up clearly in the numbers the corporation reported to Wall Street, and certainly not in the numbers it emphasized in public and investor presentations. But over time, the higher proportion of gas investments could threaten the corporation's impressive record of profitability.